Hello and welcome to Lush Tums, the podcast, supporting you on your mothering journey during pregnancy, birth and beyond. Through yoga, education and community, we enable every woman we work with to connect more deeply to herself and her own innate wisdom. Find your tribe as you become a parent, making positive, informed choices that are right for you, because Lush Tums believes everything has a place. Join the two Claires as we connect, laugh and learn. In this space, everything is welcome. Hi everyone, welcome to Lush Tums the podcast. I'm Claire McGill.
And I'm Claire Maddalena.
Today we are joined by Dr. Ali Granderson, Director of the Surrey Baby Lab, a research team interested in understanding how infants and children interact with their environment and if how we learn language has an influence on the way we perceive the world. She has been attending Claire's pregnancy, postnatal and women's classes for 6 years since she became a mother and is now attending pregnancy yoga again for the third time. During her second pregnancy, she wrote a weekly diary for Lush Tums blog, cataloguing her journey in a funny and relatable way. Welcome, Ali. Thank you for being with us today.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. It's lovely to be here with you.
I'd love to ask you, Ali, your work sounds so interesting. How did you get there? Where did it all begin?
It's been a bit of a journey, really. I guess I started with my interest in psychology. From being a youngster, actually, it's kind of this love of human beings and a passion for understanding what makes us human and getting to the bottom of that. My dad worked as a child psychotherapist, which was really fascinating for me. But I also knew, I think, when I kind of learned more about psychology, that I didn't really want to go down that clinical route and that wasn't kind of quite what I was interested in and was sort of most passionate about. So I did an undergraduate degree in psychology at the University of Bath, and that was a four-year degree. And my third year, I was really lucky to do a work placement where I worked as a research assistant in a research lab. So I learned loads about research. I got to go out to Namibia and conduct research out in the field and learned tons doing that. I was there for nearly 2 months. And then after my undergraduate degree, that kind of just led me on to the next stage, which was a PhD, studying what I'd looked at during my placement year in a bit more detail. So learning about colour categorisation, learning about this role between language and thought and whether the words that we have for things and the labels we give things have an impact on our understanding and our conceptualisation of the world around us. And that kind of progressed so through to a lectureship. And I've been working at the Surrey Baby Lab since around 2013 as the director, and love my job. I'm really lucky to do lots of brilliant work on research, but I also teach brilliant students and look after them and make sure that they have a good journey. That's really important to what I do. And I run one of our master's courses as well at the moment at the University of Surrey. So lots of kind of different stuff going on.
Sounds so exciting. And I wonder, what does a day look like for you at work? How do you figure out what babies are thinking?
That's a really good question. Yeah, and the research side of it is a big part of what I do. So I'm really passionate about that because it's so intriguing to have these unanswered questions and to kind of want to know about things. And babies particularly are fascinating. They're these amazing little beings that come into the world, and actually through my research I've learned that there's an awful lot that they do know and a lot that they can work out about the world. But when I look at them initially, they don't have words for things, they don't have language, so I want to kind of find out what's going on in their worlds. And we do that in our lab in lots of different ways. So during COVID, we'd be doing lots of online stuff, not having babies into the lab. But typically, we'd have babies come into our lab and we'd use things like eye tracking, where we have a special camera that follows where a baby's looking so we can see what's interesting for them, what's capturing their attention on a screen. And that can tell us a lot about what they're understanding, how they're thinking about things and whether they can tell the difference between certain objects. We also use a technique called EEG or electroencephalography, which uses little sensors that pick up brain waves. So we can kind of find out what's going on in a baby's brain when they're looking at certain objects. So that's been really, really fascinating and really interesting as well, to kind of work out what's going on. What do their brains do when we show them different colours or different stimuli? And do they understand that they're different, and therefore what does that tell us about how they're making those connections or understanding the relationships between objects? And we tend to do things as well through play. So I'm doing a lot of studies with older kids as well. So we look at babies, but we look right across development. So toddlers as they learn language, older kids as well, all through adolescence and adulthood also. So we look at adults who speak different languages all around the world. We kind of use play, games. I'm doing a brilliant study at the moment where we're getting 5 and 6 year olds and 8 and 9 year olds to draw pictures for us to tell us how they understand gender pronouns and make sense of those. So lots of kind of different techniques that we use to find out what's going on.
Wow, it sounds utterly fascinating. And already my brain's whirling and I'm thinking, you know, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? Is it kind of, do they come with all these ideas about what the world's going to be like, maybe even from their in utero experience, or is a lot of it just learned from the people around them, the spaces they're in and their environment and the nurture? What would you speak about that then, Ali?
Yeah, I could say a lot about that. That's a really good question and a really fascinating one. And this kind of nature-nurture debate's been really central to psychology for decades now. And actually the work that I've done has really helped to develop a particular theory on that. So as often is the case, it's kind of not one thing or the other. It's certainly a combination. So in the work that I do, I'm really interested to know, what's this relationship between language and thought? So is it language? Is it the words that we speak and the labels we give to things that's driving our understanding and our perception? Or is it kind of something that's more kind of biological and innate and perceptual? So if that's the case, we would be kind of the same across the world, no matter what language we're speaking. And the work that I've done in the lab looks like we kind of have these templates for categories when we come into the world. So babies kind of understand colour categories, for example. They understand categorisation in lots of different domains. So whether that's faces, different types of forms, animals, and as I say, colour's kind of one that I've looked at in an awful lot of detail as well. So they have colour categories from a very early age, and then when they start to learn their words for colours, language starts to have an influence, and it can then kind of shape the way that we're understanding the categories or why we're categorising, sort of the kind of foundations for that process of making sense of the world. And then again, in adulthood, we often see lots of differences across different speakers of different languages. So languages vary massively across the world, and we kind of carve up different elements of things into different numbers of categories, and we categorize in different ways based on different concepts. And there we see quite a role of language, where we have different words or different numbers of words for things. We can see very different responses to things in adults. So it's quite a developmental trajectory. And again, that's why I kind of look across development, and we look at babies, but we look all the way through to adulthood. And that's kind of helped us to get to the bottom of those questions and make sense of that.
Gosh, wow. So my next question is, you know, we've got, you know, babies that can see colours, and that categorisation happens really early, which already I'm quite fascinated in. But what about babies that can't see so well, or maybe they see more in shades of grey? I've come across somebody once that only saw in shades of grey. Does that mean their interpretation of the world and the language, and then maybe even some of their ideas or beliefs, would be slightly different?
Yeah, possibly. And that's a really difficult question to answer, actually, and to get to the bottom of, but it certainly looks like it could be the case. I think, you know, we're influenced very heavily by our visual environment, and vision's a really important sense for us. It's not the only sense, it's not the only way of doing things, but it's certainly there for us. And it develops a lot over the first year of life. So babies from about a month of age have what we call kind of quite high visual acuity. So babies from about 1 month of age have very low visual acuity. So compared to adults who might have what we call 20/20 vision, infants might have 20/200 vision. So where they would see what an adult can see at 200 feet, they would see at 20 feet, for example. So it's kind of blurry for them, a little bit fuzzy when they're very, very young. In terms of colour, when they're about 3 months of age, they have all the kind of mechanisms in place biologically to see colour as an adult would, and that's what we call trichromatic vision, but they have to learn how to use those mechanisms. So it's not until about 8 months of age that they kind of have more adult-like colour vision. So there's that really kind of big journey as a baby where they're, you know, initially there's a lot of kind of fuzziness in their vision. They have to see things very closely. Things have to be very high contrast as well for them to be able to differentiate between them. And that's where things like black and white are really great. So we often see a lot of black and white toys, don't we, and stimuli for babies. And that's a really great thing to have if you want to stimulate your baby. That's quite likely they'll be able to see those sorts of contrasts, those black and white contrasts. So that's a really great thing. But yeah, there's kind of lots more research going on about how that has an impact on our experience as well. And as I said, that's a really difficult thing to get to the bottom of with babies, because they can't tell us. We can't sit down and do a podcast with them and ask them lots of brilliant questions, which would be amazing, but we have to kind of find out these things from seeing how they respond to objects and how they look at things and react.
And it's quite nice that their world is quite small initially. You know, if things further away are quite fuzzy, it means that they have to focus more on what's right in front of them, which would hopefully be, you know, a loving parent's gaze and, you know, that kind of interaction and smiles and giggles, and building up that kind of emotional bonding side of things. It seems like that's obviously really important then at that stage, if that's as far as they can see.
Yeah, definitely. And there's lots of really interesting work that's looked at this sort of visual ability in infants as well. And that kind of taps into that environment and how they're raised when they're very little. So for example, they tend to look much longer at curved objects than they do very kind of set, sharp, straight lines. And that makes sense because those are the kinds of objects that they see around them. They might see faces, they might see breasts as well when they're kind of close, and different human forms, whereas they're not necessarily exposed to all these kind of sharp lines. So I think, you know, their kind of looking behaviour is mirroring what they're able to see. And there's kind of definitely a link there, which is really fascinating.
With all this work you've done, how has it influenced your parenting?
I kind of had these visions maybe before becoming a parent that, you know, I might be like Piaget and kind of be totally focused on my kids and totally researching them all the time and noting down their developmental stages and video recording them. And actually, I've done absolutely none of that, and that's been quite nice. So it's really kind of helpful for me as a parent, I think, to kind of, to a degree, disconnect myself as a researcher. So when I'm parenting, my kids are, they kind of just do what they want to do. And if that doesn't map onto kind of stages of development or kind of things that I know about development, that's absolutely fine. Because I think when you start to learn about these things, you can become a bit obsessed about different developmental stages and when they should be doing what. And actually, there's so much individual variation as well with kids all through development, which is really fascinating. And they do have their own journeys. And so I think, you know, that's been a really important lesson for me, actually, to not be monitoring things really closely. So yes, there are certain things that I can take from my research. So for example, you know, my knowledge of colour vision, that's really helped me to think about toys. I'm kind of fussy a little bit when I choose toys for my kids, particularly when they're really little. So yeah, I'll often go for kind of high contrast black and white toys when they're, you know, very little, because I know that's something that they can see and they can look at. I've also done quite a lot of work on colour preference in my lab too. So that's shown us as well that babies look longer at primary colours compared to secondary colours, for example. So they might look longer at red compared to pink and brown, for example. So again, these kind of brighter, more saturated colours are ones that are good for them to see. And I often get asked the question, so, you know, what colour should I paint my nursery in? And I certainly wouldn't say, you know, rush out and paint the nursery red. Don't, you know, don't necessarily do that, because longer looking doesn't necessarily mean preference, that they like it more, just means it kind of grabs their attention. And it also means it stimulates them too. So actually, your nursery, you probably want them to be kind of colours that they can't tell lots of difference between, and there's not loads of high contrast where they're going to be kind of fixating on things, because it's supposed to be a kind of relaxing, chilled out environment. So I think those things have kind of factored into my colour choices and toys and decorations. And what I said about kind of just letting them go their own way and have their own journey, which is really important.
So from what I'm hearing, it sounds as if what we're seeing in the world around us and then the labels and language we put on it is giving us an understanding of what that landscape is. And then just to kind of go into the sort of psychology, maybe end of the conversation, could we also say then that some of the language that we might hear from those around us might actually influence us as we're growing from childhood, in terms of our ideas and beliefs maybe about ourselves? You know, that classic example that I sometimes come across, you know, when I'm working with parents, when they're kind of describing their little one, and it can be, oh, you know, it can be, oh, he's such an angel, but it can also be the other end of the spectrum of, you know, he's so shy, or he's so lazy, or he's a monster, or she's this, or she's that. Are those phrases that we often maybe throw around without thinking, do they have an impact on a child's reference point about themselves? And what would you say about all of that?
Yeah, I think they do. And I think that comes back to the power of language, really. I think language is potentially really powerful. I think our choice of words is quite critical as well, and how we speak. And, you know, language is something that most adults possess and we use in day-to-day life all the time. So it kind of is something we take for granted. And we can therefore kind of use words quite flippantly or casually. But I think there is a lot of power in that. There's a lot of impact potentially, isn't there? And I think, you know, the example you give about labels for children is a really good one. And there is work to suggest that's impactful, that the way that we describe things, you know, particular semantics can have a real big impact. And that's certainly been something that's been kind of central to my journey with language and my interest in language. And, you know, thinking about language from a research perspective, its interaction with thought, but I'm always also really kind of interested in language. The relative impact and how we use words. And that kind of feeds into my journey as a writer, I think, and how I've, you know, put words together to kind of craft stories or to craft kind of narratives about things. And I think, you know, we all use words in very different, individual, unique ways. And how we do that can have a very different impact on people's understandings, people's conceptualizations, and people's kind of self evaluations as well, which is really powerful and something to be aware of, I think.
What kind of conclusions have you drawn from some of your research?
So I think this kind of theory about how language impacts our understanding of the world is really central. So I've learned a lot about categorization. So when I say that I look at language and I look at thought and I look at categorization, that might not seem instantly obvious where the connection is, but categorization is basically a way of making sense of the world. So as human beings, we kind of wander around and our senses are constantly bombarded by lots of different information in all of our senses. And one way of making us appreciate that and understand it is by breaking it down. So we kind of break it down and we analyze it, and therefore we categorize it. So we kind of put it into different boxes, if you like, or different chunks to make sense of it. So I guess my work's shown that process is something that's really fundamental to us as human beings. We categorize all the time. And it's also shown that looking at categorization can tell us a lot about words. So that journey across development has been really, really fascinating, where the work that I've done with very young infants, showing that their brains respond to different colour categories, for example, from a very early age, so they can instantly sort of recognise that a blue is a blue and a green is a green, for example. They know those categories are there and they respond in that way, but they don't have the words for that. So it shows us that process of categorisation is kind of built in. So I find that quite comforting and reassuring in a way, because, you know, imagine a baby's environment, it's kind of quite confusing and quite overwhelming potentially, but to know that they have these mechanisms in place from a very, very early age to help them make sense of that and understand it and break it down is kind of quite a nice thing to think about, I think. So knowing that that's in place from a very early age, and actually that infants kind of come into the world armed with lots of different abilities, and I certainly think they're learning in utero as well. They're picking up on stimuli, they can hear from a very early age in utero as well, so kind of, you know, building on that as they come out, And then language kind of is quite central to their development. So when they start to actually learn words for things, and that happens at, you know, there's quite a big developmental window where that would happen. And that happens for different types of categories in, at different stages. But the fact that then the words that they start to assign for to things have an impact on how they understand those things. So it almost brings about a structure for them and is kind of like another way of understanding things. So it's quite helpful to kind of see all these different tools and mechanisms as human beings that we can use as we grow and develop, and just kind of helps us make sense of life, I guess, which is, yeah, which is quite helpful to know.
It's listening to what you're saying, it seems as if we have this natural ability and tendency to categorize slash compartmentalize big things, to bring them into smaller parts so we can make sense of them. But then sometimes when we're an adult, it can also be a bit of a disadvantage, that skill, because actually we need to see the whole picture sometimes and, you know, take things out of their boxes that we've put them in to make sense of them and join the dots. And then actually at some other points later in our life, part of the journey, I think, is that we've got to undo all the boxes and have a look what's in there and put it all back together again and be whole. Is there anything you might speak to about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's really interesting. I think that kind of picks up on the point we were discussing earlier about there being lots of different ways to look at things. And, you know, even with categorization, that's a good example of that. There are lots of different ways that we can categorize. We can categorize based on the words that we have, but we can categorize based on perceptual properties or different elements of things, or our own intuition or our understanding about things. So, yeah, being aware of that and kind of seeing different perspectives is really important. And also, I like the way that you've described that, that kind of notion of stepping back and uncategorizing, if you like, and seeing things as a whole is definitely a way to go. And I think, you know, we do that more as adults, don't we? Because, you know, we naturally kind of have more sophisticated cognition, and we also interact in the world with the world in a different way, and we have quite a lot of complex interactions. So I think we all find our own pathways of how we make sense of that as we go forward and learn from other people as well. I don't think it's a static process, so we might do things one way and then we do things in a different way. And I think, again, motherhood's a great example of that, isn't it, of kind of changing your perspective, changing your approach and your outlook, and seeing things very differently. And we often do that as a prompt from our children. They kind of teach us certain things, don't they, and we think, oh, okay, yeah, that's great, I kind of didn't have that insight before, but that's something that I can have now and see very differently.
Maybe we could have a little chat as well about, you know, that journey of, you know, pregnancy, birth, those big events, becoming mothers, observing our children, observing how they learn and develop, and, you know, how they act as little teachers and mirrors for our own self-awareness and development, and some of the crisis points that we might go through as a new mum. Is there anything that you'd like to share about that from your research or from your own experiences?
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about this kind of journey recently, and I think, you know, particularly at the moment, I'm pregnant with my third baby, which is, you know, a really kind of amazing time. It's a really brilliant time, and I feel very kind of lucky and grateful for that at the moment. But you're naturally kind of looking back, aren't you, and comparing this current experience to what my previous experiences might have been as well. And that's really interesting to do that. And, you know, I was thinking, how would we explain this journey to an alien if we were to kind of meet one and to say what was going on? And it's kind of bonkers, isn't it? So, like, we grow this little thing in our bellies inside of us for 9 months, and we kind of, you know, we give everything to it. We kind of nourish it with our bodies, and it grows from, like, nothing into this fully formed little person. And then we squeeze it out of our vaginas. Yes, yes, our vaginas, which is kind of bonkers, isn't it? And then, yeah, or somebody cuts a big hole in us and rips it out of the sunroof as well. Do you know, it kind of comes out one way or another. And then it's completely helpless for these first months as well. So this fourth trimester period, and we have to nourish it with our bodies again, feeding it milk from our breast or feeding it with a bottle and making sure that it's fed and looked after and warm and loved and nourished. And we again have to give all of ourselves to do that. And if you kind of explain that journey to someone that would never have kind of encountered that before, it sounds pretty bonkers, doesn't it? But it sounds incredible and amazing as well. And I think that really resonates as a mother, that before you become a parent, you can't really conceptualize that. You know it's going to be big, and you know it's going to be life-changing, you know it's going to be hard, and you know it's going to be amazing, all of those cliches, but you really have no experience of that until you're in it. And I think that's been a surprise for me, the kind of extent to which I've been on that journey. So the kind of the extent of the highs and also the extent of the lows as well, and kind of seeing both sides of it and really kind of feeling that and feeling it in very different ways with different pregnancies and with different my different children as well, has been a really interesting journey, I think.
Are there any tips that you would give to parents or parents-to-be around what you've learned from your work?
I think that's a great question, and almost my answer kind of like negates that in a way, because I think my answer would be that it's your journey. So almost me telling somebody kind of is not a valid thing. But I think we all have our different experiences and our different journeys. And I think one thing that's particularly difficult first time around is trusting yourself, trusting your judgment and your instinct. And I think, you know, that knowledge or that empowerment that you know your baby better than anybody else. So, you know, doctors or midwives or, you know, GPs can tell you certain things, or friends or family can give you advice, but you know what your situation is and your baby, what they're like and what that kind of means and how that enacts. And I think that's really important, so that we can kind of make our own decisions and our own judgments, and also feel confident in doing that. And I, you know, that's easier said than done, particularly first time round, because it's so new and it's so, you know, everything is kind of new and different and overwhelming, and it's, you know, there's nothing like that culture shock of going from naught to one, I think. But I think, you know, doing that in your own way is really important, and knowing that's okay too. So being able to connect with other people that do things differently is also incredibly important, and not thinking that there's a right or a wrong way to do things, not always getting that kind of judgment or comparison. And I think I've been incredibly lucky with that, actually, because I've got an amazing group of friends, many of whom I met during my yoga journey. So when I did postnatal yoga after having my first son, I met a big group of women, which was just amazing. And yeah, we all started to kind of socialise and support each other and connect. And that was really incredible. And I'm still friends with them now. A lot of us had second kids at the same time, and we've just really supported each other on that journey. And central to that has been kind of a lack of judgment. So we just kind of, you know, we value each other and we share our experiences and our journeys, and we support each other in that. But we don't judge each other if we're doing something in a slightly different way, or, you know, we're kind of keen to learn from each other as well, because you never stop learning on this journey, and every kid is different as well. So I know that this baby that I'm carrying at the moment is going to teach me lots of different things as well, and that this experience third time round is going to be very different to my last experience and my first experience, and that's kind of cool and exciting as well. So yeah,
that's fantastic. I think that very much echoes some of the things that we feel are so important: trusting yourself, trusting your instincts, finding your tribe, moving away from judgmental ideas or thoughts, accepting things as they come and finding a way to flow with them is very much right from the beginning of our pregnancy classes all the way through our classes. That's one of the kind of key messages that we want people to take away and to hopefully experience in their lives. I was going to ask you whether, as you were talking then and about your journey, it reminded me, similarly, I suffered from postnatal depression with the birth of my first child, and part of the therapy I went through was actually cognitive behavioral therapy, which works very much around changing your language and the thoughts, and then seeing that affect your feelings and therefore your behaviour. And I'm wondering if you're, as Claire was saying earlier, are you starting to see this from the beginning? At what stage do our thoughts start to affect our feelings, or perhaps the language we use affect us emotionally?
Yeah, I think that connection is really real and really, really fundamental. As I said, you know, language is very powerful. It's connected with our thoughts, with our feelings. It's connected with our kind of culture and our environment as well. And all of those things kind of feed into those experiences. And it's, yeah, it's great to hear as well that, that cognitive behavioural therapy is being used to support women that have postnatal depression. I think that can be a really powerful tool for doing that. And it's, yeah, it's something that I experienced as well after the birth of my second child. So I kind of had, again, tapping back into what I was saying about very different experiences. I had my first son and I kind of, yeah, I was on cloud nine and I had a lovely time and I built up this brilliant social circle and yeah, and kind of just felt really empowered at that point and yeah, and really happy and it was kind of a really lovely time and I remember it very clearly as well. And then my experience of motherhood second time around was really different and I had very different challenges and I kind of look back now and I think actually, you know, I'd just gone back to work. My kids are very close in age, so my eldest son was just two and my second son was born. And yeah, I'd had a miscarriage before having my second son as well, so kind of been through a lot. And I was a bit exhausted, you know, we're kind of doing everything, aren't we? We run around and we care for the children, then we, you know, put pressure on ourselves to go back to work at a certain time and then to be, great at work and a great parent and juggle those things, you know, as well as being a great partner and fulfilling all the kind of demands of our family life and managing all of that. And it's, you know, it's really, really hard. It's really challenging. And then I think, you know, I had my second son and it was only really not until he was about 7 months of age that I realised that, okay, this isn't just, you know, just it's hard. This is, you know, this is something a little bit different. This is something that I maybe need to get some support for or get checked out. And I remember very vividly actually going for a walk with one of my really close friends. And yeah, she had a second baby around the same time. And we were both kind of struggling a little bit and finding it quite tough and talking. And I'd been to an appointment with the midwife and they'd asked me all about my baby. And we kind of checked in and I said to my friend, you know, she didn't ask me how I was, and I think if she had done, I either would have burst into tears or I would have said, I'm not okay. And you know, and that actually, that realization for me was important because I realized I wasn't okay and that I needed to get some support and some help, and I sought that out, and that was really kind of, yeah, a massive transition for me. I think for me that transition from one to two was just really difficult. It was, yeah, really physical as well, so having quite a young older child and then juggling that with a little one, and you know, and they're all different as well and different stages of kind of demands, and that being really, really challenging and really difficult. But yeah, it was talking therapies that really, really helped me, and I kind of found myself again, which was, yeah, I kind of look back and I, again, as I say, I've got a really vivid memory of my first kind of year with my eldest son, and that's really hazy with my second son, and yeah, not kind of there very much, and I felt like my senses were really dull at that time. I couldn't really hear what people were saying. I think I used to talk really loudly because I couldn't hear myself, and you've always got a baby crying and a toddler asking you to get them a snack or whatever, and it's, yeah, it's quite overwhelming. So a big part of my journey, I think, so hopefully as well helpful to share that, and yeah, and thank you, Claire, for sharing your experience too, because I think it's one that a lot of mothers actually experience and go through, and that the support out there at the moment is, you know, it's relatively limited, isn't it? It can be really hard to seek that support, but really important too, and sort of important for us to recognise that these feelings are more than what we should be dealing with as well. Yes, motherhood's hard, but there are certain things that mean that it's kind of harder than it should be, and we can get support for that and help for that.
And you've been practicing yoga pretty much every week with Claire. Can you tell us a little bit about how that's supported your journey?
Yeah, I love being a Lush Tums vet. I can give myself that label, I think. So yeah, and yeah, it's been incredible, actually, been a really central part of my journey. I moved to Brighton in 2015 when I was pregnant with my eldest son, and I really wanted to do a yoga class. I was doing yoga before that. I was kind of running a lot. So I did the London Marathon back in 2012, and yoga was a really brilliant way for me pre-pregnancy to kind of support that and get my core strength and really kind of support my running. Just as a point, I wasn't part of the 2012 Olympics, kind of scale that back a little bit. I was just kind of barely getting to the end of the course. So I'm a runner, but not like a super amazing runner. But yeah, loving running and doing that, and loving yoga as a support for that. So when I found out I was pregnant and we moved to Brighton, I really wanted to find a pregnancy yoga class, which was quite new for me. I remember a friend recommending Lush Tums, so I looked you up, and I have a really vivid memory actually of my first class. I think we were in the Happy Cell on Dubbingdor Road and coming along, and I felt really nervous for some reason. Like, I think I was probably about 14 weeks pregnant and just kind of going into a room with lots of women who I didn't know and not knowing what quite what to expect. Although, you know, I'd done yoga and I knew what yoga was about, but pregnancy yoga feeling quite different. And I just remember instantly feeling this like warmth and, yeah, and welcome from you. And it was just really lovely and kind of everything felt easy. And you sort of, you know, welcomed me and told me what I needed and what I needed to do as a new person. And then we had the Hello Circle, and that was really brilliant. It was a lovely way to hear from other pregnant women about their experiences. And, you know, being 14 or so weeks, quite early days, it was great to hear what they were going through at, you know, 34 weeks or 28 weeks or whatever. And that was really, really helpful. And everyone was really friendly and lovely, and I made loads of connections through that. So that was amazing. And then similarly, postnatal yoga was absolutely brilliant. So that was great to bring my son along. And as I said, that's where I met tons of friends. I've got this amazing group. We still have our WhatsApp group, the Yoga Mums, and we all refer to each other as the Yoga Mums. And we've kind of met other brilliant mums at other groups who've joined us along the way, who are, yeah, surrogate yoga mums. And yeah, and we're so lucky. So that was a really brilliant thing to do. And then again, women's yoga. I've loved women's yoga. And for me, particularly with postnatal depression, actually, that was a really important part of that journey and that recovery. Finding time for myself and looking after myself was just fundamental to that. And I kind of lost that. I just didn't have an ability to do that because I was totally immersed in motherhood and looking after my children and giving them everything and thinking that that was a great thing to do. And actually, I kind of learned that you can't do that really effectively unless you're looking after yourself. So yoga's been absolutely central to that process for me, just making time for myself each week. And I remember making that transition back to women's yoga and thinking, you know, I can't do this. I can't fit this in my week. This just feels absolutely impossible. And I just sat down with my husband and talked to him about that. And we said, OK, well, maybe you could do bedtime that night and we'll switch it round, or we'll, you know, I'll finish work at this time and we'll make it work. And we did. And then I did it and it was like, oh yeah, that was easy. Okay, we can do that. But what felt impossible then was, yeah, a really fundamental part of my week of just having that headspace each week just to kind of, yeah, connect to myself again and give myself some time physically as well, just, you know, kind of feeling really kind of empowered as well and energized by the classes, which was really brilliant, particularly at that time. So I think it's given me so much and in slightly different ways for all the different classes. But yeah, that kind of connection to yourself, to your baby, to your journey, that insight, that time for yourself, that kind of nurturing, the community, the kind of, you know, the friends that I've made through it as well. It's been, yeah, been amazing. And it's been a really important part of my journey.
Oh, thank you. I'm honoured to have been a part of your journey, Ali. Thank you. Is there anything that you would want to say, you know, we're all about empowering women throughout pregnancy, birth and life as a mother, however old their children are. Is there anything you'd like to say to women on that journey?
You absolutely need to look after yourself. I think that's super important. So just massive respect to all mothers out there and whatever experience they're having and how they're doing that, really. And I, you know, would hope that we all are able to see that as well and to kind of appreciate what we're doing. I think there's a really great mantra from yoga, actually, the I am enough, I have enough, I do enough is really lovely. I don't know if that's the right order, but just that I remember hearing that for the first time and just going, yeah, wow, that's amazing. So
that is one of my go-to mantras, and it really helps when I'm feeling, you know, overwhelmed or there's too much work going on or there's, you know, you're pulled from pillar to post. It's like, actually, I'm only human. I've only got so many hours in the day. I am enough, I have enough, I do enough. And it really gives myself with that permission to, you know, stop doing the rushing around, give myself, you know, 20 minutes to sit and have a cup of tea and look out the window, recharge. It really gives myself permission to carve out those moments each day for self-care. So yeah, thanks for reflecting that mantra back. It's a good one.
Definitely. I use it very often as well, and particularly when we can get caught on that thought pattern of I should trying to obtain perfection or believing that you could be doing it better all the time. And actually just those few words give you that reframe to remind you, and enough is as good as a feast, as they say, and enough is enough. So yeah, I love those ones too. We have three questions that we really like to ask our guests, Ali. we offer the statement, I'm a yoga teacher, but, and then we share our so-called guilty confessions about things that perhaps don't fit the narrative around what it is to be a yoga teacher. Now, you're not a yoga teacher, but you are a yoga practitioner.
Yeah, I would say I'm a yogi, but I have thighs the size of yoga bolsters. They're massive. And I'm not going to apologise for that. So, yeah, I think that kind of shows us that we can practice yoga being all different shapes and sizes. And we don't have to be kind of what we think about as a yoga teacher or a yogi, being kind of very slim and lean and flexible with our ankles around the backs of our necks, because I certainly can't do that. But I still love yoga and I get a lot from yoga. My body makes maybe different shapes, but that's okay. It is really a valuable thing for my body. So that would be my not fitting the stereotype of being a yogi.
That's brilliant. I love that. And you're absolutely right. I think this is why we actually have this feature, is to really dispel some of the myths and the ideas around, I think Instagram has a lot to answer for in terms of what yoga should look like. And realistically, it doesn't reflect the experience of millions of practitioners all over the world who look absolutely nothing like those glossy, shiny headstands. So thank you for sharing. And yes, absolutely. What about you today, Claire? What's your guilty confession?
I'm a yoga teacher, but my favourite bit of yoga practice is the lying down at the end and having a little sleep. I love a body scan. I love a little visualisation. I love a nidra practice. There's so many of them out there. If you haven't come across them, there's obviously going to be some on our website that you can find. But that's my favourite bit of the whole of the yoga thing, is that bit at the very end. And then that feeling that you get after that when you come back round and you just feel present and calm and grounded. So I'm a yoga teacher, but it's all about the nap.
With you on that.
I'm wondering how many other people are nodding out there. Let us know, guys. Is Shavasana your favourite as well? Is the Nidra your favourite? I think I agree, actually. I think that maybe the thing that drew me in the most was how good it felt after the movement as well, particularly, and how it really, I felt like in that place, the biggest transformation happens. I'm a yoga teacher, but I think I shout at least 10 times a day, every day, about something. I always have that moment where I'm out with my kids in the park and I bump into some of my students and I kind of go, oh no, they're going to see what I'm really like. They're going to realise I'm not all calm and even toned, and there is definitely some get down from there happening. Don't run into the road. Yes, I'm a yoga teacher, but I shout a lot, and perhaps the calmness that I might bring to my classes is not there 24/7.
And that is reality.
And the other question we like to ask is, what are you grateful for in your life right now?
Yeah, I feel really grateful at the moment for lots of things. And I think I would have to say this pregnancy, actually. It's been really kind of transformative, my journey from having two to feeling like I could never do it again, and then to really realising that actually that was something that I really wanted to do and to have a chance to do and to enjoy in a different way. So kind of reconnecting with that, giving myself space to do that. Reconnecting with the kind of joy that comes around that. I'm not saying it's all super joyful, so like having massive nipples and nausea and swollen feet is not super joyful all the time, but there's so much joy in that process and engaging with that. So I feel really, really lucky to be able to go through that again. And obviously the pregnancy is just the start of that journey, so that feels really exciting. And that kind of comes off the back of a really difficult, bonkers year for me and for everybody that we've all experienced. So it's really lovely to have something super positive to look forward to, and I'm incredibly grateful for that.
Oh, that's lovely.
Thanks, Ali. That is lovely. Wish you so much wellness and happiness and health on your journey, darling.
What are you grateful for, Claire?
Well, I am involved in a lovely women's circle. And as Ali was mentioning, we always hold a hello circle at the beginning of our classes. So I'm well experienced in holding that space for others, but probably haven't really lent into it for myself. And in about the last 6 months, I've connected in with a brilliant menstrual cycle awareness group. And that hopefully will be another podcast for us one day to get those guys on and have a chat. And we have continued with a women's circle. So last night I had a lovely couple of hours on Zoom because we're all over the place, all across the country. So tech really helped. And it was just wonderful to see some faces, to go deep with some conversations and to do what we do in our Lush Tums classes, really, to have a chance for me to be seen and heard, acknowledged and held with all the little nuances going on in my head and heart. And just absolutely adore that time and space and just woke up feeling back on track and ready to go. So feeling super grateful to all those women in my circle. If you're listening, you know who you are, you special ladies. And yeah, if you're not in a women's circle of any kind, then find one or get yourself along to a Lush Tums class and start connecting in, because it's super duper, really rewarding.
That's so lovely. I am grateful for my partners today. So yesterday I was having a particularly tough day emotionally and really struggling, and both of my partners in my life showed up. So my husband phoned me and by the end of the conversation had me laughing and had bought me some much needed balm and some grounding, and really helped me by supporting me through those difficult feelings. And then later on in the day, you, Claire, phoned me as well, just as I was facing another difficult emotion, and you really held the space for me and gave me some much needed words of encouragement, and it just changed my whole day. I think that feeling of support, you know, the right person at the right time coming through for you, what a difference that makes. And it made what was probably a really difficult and horrible day in so many ways, that was my silver lining, and actually shaped the rest of my day to follow through so much better than it might otherwise have been. So thank you, Claire. And thank you, my darling husband, as well, for being there for me and being my partners.
Yay.
The last thing we like to ask our guests is, we believe that every pregnancy or every baby brings a gift with it. Maybe a quality you didn't have before, maybe a shift in understanding or perception, maybe a personality trait. Do you agree? And what do you think your babies have brought you?
Yeah, I do. That's a really lovely question, actually. And I've enjoyed kind of thinking about this and working out the answer. I think my eldest brought me the gift of mindfulness. I really loved when he was little slowing down and kind of walking and narrating and looking at flowers or buds emerging or clouds passing by, which I hadn't done for a really long time as an adult, and we often don't. I think we rush around, and that slowing down and that sense of noticing and sharing the kind of wonder and awe and amazement with him as he was so little and all these things he was experiencing for the first time was really beautiful and a really lovely gift. And I don't do that all the time now, but it's a really nice thing to stop and remember and to try and integrate into my day whenever I can, and try and get some of that mindfulness. And then my second baby, really different, I think. So again, learning profoundly that there is no one perfect way to do things, that you can do things in a really different way, and that's totally valid. And learning that there's kind of so much joy that can come from being in a really difficult place as well. So he is such a joyful, happy little boy. And yeah, and often I didn't feel that way when he was very little. So, you know, he didn't realize that, he didn't experience that, and having that joy and having that difference of experience is really important. So knowing that that was okay and that was fine and he's fine is really important and empowering. And then this final one so far, again, this might change as we go forward. But yeah, again, reconnecting with that sense of joy is really lovely and feeling grateful. And that's really a really important gift for me and feels really magical at the moment.
Oh, so wonderful, Ali. Thank you so much for joining us today and sharing so much wisdom and fascinating science and facts. It's been really, really, really interesting being with me on the Lush Tums journey since the beginning. I feel really inspired. So thank you.
Amazing. Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to be here and chat to you both, and a real honour to be asked as well. So it's a real lovely thing to be able to come and talk about my journey with Lush Tums and my professional journey and share that. And I hope it's been useful for listeners out there as well. So thank you both for that.
Oh, thank you, Ali. You've been a pleasure to speak to, and I've found what all you've said really, really fascinating. Thank you.
Oh, love you.
Love you too.
Oh, I feel like I'm gate crashing here.
Can you have raspberries and gooseberries on a Zencastle call? We can now. Ali, close your eyes.